This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest, just delight in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host,
the pride of Pennsylvania,
the man who shoots straight and won't steer you wrong,
Johnny Appleseed himself,
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. And I gotta be real with you, sometimes this time of year, the struggle is real in trying to get things to go the way you want it and doing this podcast amongst everything with life. So this is literally the setup that I have. Right now, I have some nieces and nephews hanging out at my house and they're sleeping over. It's right now 6 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday, the day before we release this episode. And I'll commonly, you know, get up in the morning and prepare this week's episode on a Monday or Tuesday morning. You'll get up early and record it and stuff. And this morning I got up and I went out into my little office. And as I went out there and was going to prepare to start this episode, I have one of my nieces sleeping on the couch in that office room, which I was not expecting. That's not where they started their evening out. So I literally have no room in my house that doesn't have a human in it. And for me to record this episode, I went down into my basement and I'm standing in my garage. That's the only place I could have an outlet to record this. And I'm recording an intro. How pathetic does that sound? You know, you think about some of the productions and everything else that are out there and a lot of professionals that put content out there and the way they do it. And it seems very professional and stuff. And I just feel like here I am. I'm some schmuck that barely is finding time to record an intro. And he has to do it standing up next to a tool shed and next to a car. Because it's the outlet in the house that he can talk and he's not going to wake somebody up. I swear, sometimes it's just the way it's meant to be. But you know what? I'm still having fun with it. I still enjoy bringing these episodes to you. I got another question for you guys. Does it hurt you as much as it hurts me when it comes to buying expensive things such as a vehicle? Because I got to tell you, I bought my wife a car, and she does not know it yet. She knows we were going to get a new car. We talked about it together and made, you know, plans financially and stuff. You know, we have a 2016 Subaru Forester, which has been great for us. It's got, you know, got 110,000 miles on it, and it just, like, there's nothing wrong with it. And if it were up to me, the way I would normally do things, I would just run the thing into the ground until it's absolutely useless. But we're at a point now where we just need a little bit bigger vehicle for our day-to-day routines and for running kids around and if we go on a vacation and stuff. And we decided that we were going to get rid of her car and get a car that was a little bit better suited for us. So I started doing some research, and I found a new-to-me car. It was came off of a 3-year lease and bought this car a little bit bigger. And again, we're gonna surprise her tonight with this birthday gift. Her birthday is next week, but it's going to be an early birthday gift. We're celebrating her birthday early while her family's in, and we're going to surprise her with this car. So it'll be sort of a surprise, sort of not a surprise. And it'll be cool to do that. But man, does it, like, I'm somebody who's debt free aside from my house. So to go back into debt over a car just seems dumb. Now, I could have paid the car cash, but I'm learning that sometimes it's better to just use your money wisely. And if you have the money and you get rid of it, it's not that easy to replace it. And if I put my money into some of my accounts that people that are smarter than me work with and make me some money, and it's a higher percent return than it is my interest rate on my car, I'm better off just making my highest monthly payment. But still, I feel like now I got to pay a monthly payment for 72 months for a car. And it's just like, man, that makes me feel gross. I don't know. I'm just complaining, preaching to the choir, probably. But hey, that's what summer's been. It's been a little bit chaotic. It's been a little bit fun. But you know what? I hope you had a fun 4th of July holiday. I hope you guys still have your fingers, your eyeballs, your ears. You can use everything normally. You didn't do anything stupid with fireworks. We had a fun time with family over the last week or so. Hot as all get out. Don't get me wrong, but the pool got some use. And spent some time with friends and family, and I was thankful to do all of that. Great time to celebrate. This week on our episode, I brought a friend back on. I spent a little bit of time with him last year in the fall during bear season. He came down and hunted bear in New Jersey with us and got to know him a little bit better. And I've had him on the show before, but wanted to get him back on. And, you know, this time of year, I feel like we get stuck talking about the same old, same mode. Oh, the scouting, the trail cameras, the doing this and covering ground and doing this. And hey, don't get me wrong, I love all that. We're going to do episodes like that to get us hyped up, to get us mentally prepared for the season ahead. But one of the things that gets overlooked way too often is just maintaining or improving your efficiency with your weapon. And I have Rich Yoder back on the podcast this week because Rich is one of those guys that when he does something, he is going to commit himself to doing it to the best of his ability. And he also has the gift of being a teacher. So he's been somebody that in situations where he didn't know, he had he was humble enough to go and learn and have somebody show him. And when he became insanely proficient at it, he wanted to share that, and he's passing it on, and he does instruction and stuff like that. And we're gonna do a podcast this week on just weapons, shooting, efficacy. And we just barely scratched the surface, and I felt like after this episode I wanted to do a follow-up with him, and maybe we'll try to make that happen this summer. But we're going to talk a little bit about everything in the world of shooting your bows, shooting your guns, and he talks about pistol shooting and why pistol shooting has actually improved him and many other people as an archer, and talking about shot execution and things like that. So I hope you guys get something out of this episode. A lot of fun, lot of fun recording it. And get that equipment out and get rolling with this episode. Guys, take a look at our partners here. They support us, and we're thankful to have them. Huntworth Gear. Huntworth is a Pennsylvania-based company that provides awesome hunting clothing. I wear stuff year-round. So they've got casual wear as well. You know, their Durham pants I've talked about from the hunting side of things, but they've got some solid colors and they're useful in other cases. They got a lot of cool t-shirts, hats, but they've got some hunting gear that will get you from the hottest point in hunting season, whether it's late spring turkey, early archery season, through winter with their heat boost technology. It keeps you warm, it keeps you comfortable, it feels good mobility wise. Check out huntworthgear.com. And also Little Mountain Outfitters. Little Mountain Outfitters, owned by friends of mine in Richland, Pennsylvania. And I got to tell you, I was down there this week, and I decided I was going to get a new string for my bow. I get a new string on my bow every 2 years. My bow's 10 years old, so while I was down there, I shot some of the newer bows, which I was really impressed with. Now, you got to watch. They're a little bit sneaky. They'll try to sell you a new bow even when you think you don't plan on getting one. They'll try their best, but you know what? It would have been worth it. Their bows are awesome. Their tech ability is awesome. They're a huge help. They got a lot. It's been a while since I was down to their shop, and there's been some pretty cool changes. More inventory, a new setup, more bows than I've ever seen before. And even though certain aspects of it's grown, you still got an awesome shop that's willing to help you in local. And if you can't get to Richland, Pennsylvania, you're part of the state that would be a haul for you. But you want to check out and hear what we're talking about with Little Mountain Outfitters, check out their website, littlemountainoutfitters.com. And whatever you purchase, everything bow hunting and beyond, whatever you purchase, if you use the code Woodsman10, Woodsman10, you will save 10% off of your next purchase on their website. Hey, let's get rolling on this episode. Thanks, guys. Have a great week. All right, he's back again, Mr. Rich Yoder. Thanks for joining us, my friend. How are you?
Hey, pretty good. How about yourself?
Just another day in paradise. Today is actually a weird feeling for me. So we went to the cabin over the weekend, and my parents are staying from this past weekend through to the 4th of July, and we actually left the kids with them, and I don't know what to do with myself at the moment.
That's not really a bad problem. You'll figure it out.
Probably too quickly. What I'm afraid is in the short amount of time is I'm going to get used to it, and then it's going to be a problem.
Yeah. That's funny. Well, enjoy it.
Yeah, for the time of last. I'm trying to get as many projects done as I possibly can that I would normally get pulled away for other things. But, man, what have you been up to?
Really just working, summertime swing. Usually our summer times are real busy. And that's the time when I'll try to get a lot of other things done. And usually, I mean, years prior, we've been fishing a lot or shooting rays and stuff like that. And we're just so darn busy this year, we can't really get broken away to do that. But we've been out a couple times, so it hasn't been bad. It's not been, you know, full work all summer, but it's pretty darn close.
Do you think that some of that, like how much, like when you zoom out and do a self-evaluation, how much of that is just the season of life versus just self-inflicted?
So here's how I feel about the way that work goes. And this is my 20th year in business, and it's very apparent the way that the year will go. I mean, we can almost put it on the calendar how we're going to fluctuate. And, you know, let's just say like first of the year, you know, you get through Christmas, you know, everybody, we usually don't work between Christmas and New Year's, and then everybody's starting to get into the swing of things. The kids go back to school. And for us, that's when, you know, the interior projects keep following up. That's when a lot of people are doing basements, bathroom remodels. Once we hit spring, I would say like March is almost like a fairly slow time. You know, people are tired of the cold. They're not really wanting to do much. They're ready for those first couple warm days. And usually with the first couple warm days, we get a pretty good lull just because everybody's enjoying it. They're not really thinking about projects. But once the weather breaks, then the additions start, the new houses start, then people start thinking about outdoor projects because they are outdoors. So right now is kind of a lull for us, even though we're busy as heck. But once everybody gets out of school, a lot of people go on vacation. So the month of June isn't like horrible for call-ins, but once we get into July, it'll get a little crazy. And then we have another lull in August because people are on vacation again before the school year. And then honestly, once, of course, this is every year, once hunting season hits, I'm telling you, set the date. Like PA, you know, not even goose season, but like the archery opener, our phones will ring off the hook. Like as soon as we want to be in the tree stand at night, that's when it's the busiest always. And that'll go right to the end of the year. It won't let up from September till, you know, December 31st.
Yeah, that's less than ideal. For those who are listening and don't know, Rich is an electrician, and he's a damn good one. So if you ever need electrical work, reach out to Rich. Well, Rich, I wanted to talk about off-season stuff, but from a different light that most people don't talk about. I wanted to talk about kind of dusting off our equipment, dusting off the shooting equipment, making sure we're as sharp as possible. And you've got a pretty good background in that. But before we get into that, I had a question I was thinking about tonight and I wanted to ask you. So, you know, you're from southeastern Pennsylvania. You know, you've done your fair share of things in the outdoor world. But, you know, you're a self-employed man. You work your tail off in a blue-collar job and make whatever time you possibly can to go out and enjoy creation and enjoy hunting. And I was wondering, what was your reaction the first time you did a podcast on someone's show? What was going through your mind? You thought, I'm going to be on a podcast?
So that's pretty easy pretty easy one to answer. You know, I definitely appreciate being able to talk and have fun, and I really like this type of stuff. You know, back in the day when, you know, waterfowl hunting was really kicking and I worked for Zinc Avian X and, you know, we got bought by Plano Synergy, and I mean, we got to go all over the place and we would do seminars. I mean, I was at Cabela's in Hamburg, I'll bet you 2 weekends a month. And I mean, that was the heyday. Like, you were there 2 weekends a month and you got paid to be there. Cabela's fed you. You got a vendor badge. You could buy stuff on employee. Like, it was crazy. You were nuts not to go have fun and do it. So I've definitely gotten to spend quite a bit of time talking in front of people or even talking about hunting and trying to help other people improve. So I really feel like, let's say from like just before COVID, like 2018, 2019, when a lot of like the staffs just disappeared, you know, because it really isn't, I mean, there's staffs anymore, or, you know, somebody might call himself a field staff or a pro staff, but the events aren't the same. You know, you might have something like Harrisburg where you're going to go to the Great Outdoor Show and you're going to work a booth for a couple days, maybe if you're a field staffer, or maybe you work it the whole time. But I mean, I did that show for 10 years, 9 days straight, you know, right through. But I feel like doing the podcast is almost like getting back to the way that it was, where we used to get to talk to guys and help, you know, help expand the knowledge pool to everybody that with whatever you can. And, you know, and that's why podcasts are also great, because it's not a black and white answer with everybody. You know, we all have our own way of doing it. So not everybody has a right or a wrong way, but their own way. And I think with the podcast, it's really cool to be able to get that information out there and hopefully help people. So I guess with doing my first one, I was appreciative that somebody picked me.
Well, it's an honor to have you back on In All Reality, and I got to spend a camp with you and do a little hunting with you last year, and it's really fun. And like, I wouldn't say like by any means like I'm in the outdoor industry. Like, I have a podcast on a network, and that's all I have, right? So I mean, if that's what it means, like, I got to go to the ATA show one time, and that was my badge to get in. So I guess if that makes me like have a glimpse of what the whole hunting outdoor media industry is like, great, even though I don't feel like it. But anyway, you have done a lot in the world of, you know, hunting. You were talking about Zinks earlier and all you've done in the past. Like, what is your perspective on like the outdoor industry and media at this point in your life? Good, bad, or ugly, whatever that looks like.
So it's the good, bad, and the ugly. You're not kidding. So I think there's a lot of good in it. I truly believe the way that things are, I'll say glorified or horrified, are not good, because I feel like we're really at a point of extremes where, you know, just the reason for doing things is a lot different. And that's what I feel like it's shown on the internet a lot, where, you know, you're going for a post or a picture or, you know, to simply hang something on the wall, where I wasn't brought up that way. And I enjoyed it. I mean, I would honestly bet you, I'll bet you I had more fun hunting when I was younger, before any of this stuff existed, because we just didn't care. And it's not even that I overly care now, but there's just certain things that you've got to watch and be careful of. And, you know, it's almost, I don't know. I mean, but so not that we need to bring up names, but I think we're all aware of a recent person who kind of disappeared or got canceled, I guess we'll say, for a coyote incident. And, you know, I watched that video, and I guess at the end of the day, there's a lot of things where, you know, not saying it's right, wrong, or indifferent, but you figure out, how did we get here? Like, why did that even exist? You know, even to video, to dispatch an animal, I don't know why we're videoing it, you know, when we were younger and that stuff didn't exist. I mean, you probably didn't even end up telling the story about it. But I feel like the actions of few, you know, really, I don't know, they really are thrown out of proportion, and they give a lot of bad names out there, and the way that things can go, you know, kind of south. But, you know, there's a ton of good out there. It's just, it's the internet. You know what I mean? It's like the, I don't know how or why it works this way, but it's no different than when we watch the news, you know,
right.
The bad outweighs the good every time. It's really hard to bury that down. It just keeps popping back up. And I think that's a shame for a lot of things. Just because we are outdoorsmen, there are certain things that you do that, you know, I mean, a lot of people would look down on, you know, or try and figure out why we do what we do. And, you know, it's not always when something like that happens, it's not always that somebody's, you know, 100% a cruel individual, but if you're around it enough and that's kind of the way it goes, it's not that I believe that there's ill will towards an animal, but just sometimes it's portrayed that way. You know, it might not go the way you want it to, and that's how it is.
I'm going to have to get up on my current events because I'm actually not even sure what incident you're talking about. So, my goodness, I guess maybe I'm living under a
That's all right. When you find it and watch it, you'll be like, "Oh, how did I miss this?" But I'll text you when we're done. Like I said, I didn't want to throw anybody under the bus, but and don't get me wrong, I feel indifferent about even that situation, and you know there are things that have happened in the industry over the years, you know, several big names. I mean, mm-hmm. we could ring off probably five without even trying.
Sure.
That have been brought upon, you know, the microscope for things that they did. And sometimes whether it's to create more content or, you know, just being selfish people abusing it. But either way, I feel like the media lets that come out. And I'm not saying that they should get away with what they're doing if it's wrong.
Right.
I'm just simply saying that it takes a lot of the spotlight of the good, you know, where we should really be, you know, promoting the good things and the enjoyable parts of the sport and the camaraderie and all that stuff. And like I started with, at the end of the day, it's not about putting something on the wall necessarily, even though that's awesome and great. But, you know, I feel like there's just a lot of bad choices made to, you know, to build up the media presence.
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of that has to do with ego and the pursuit of power in a lot of places. And, you know, I think you can get outside of the hunting world, and this is just life. Sometimes people just want to be known, and they want to be known for how good they are at stuff. And I'd be lying if I said that I never felt that at some point or another. And by the grace of God, I've kind of been level-headed in a lot of ways because I realize I'm not that good at a lot of the stuff I do. I just like to do it, and I get to talk about it with people. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think that really is a motivating factor behind it, is the desire to be known and well known, to be as a figure or something. And I think that can be okay, but it can get taken out of proportion way too much.
Oh, I agree 100%. Yeah. And it's unfortunate, and it's always interesting to me. So I don't know if like you ever feel this way, and there's plenty of guys out there that are just like phenomenal at what they do. Right. So kind of like talking about shooting for a quick second before we really even get into it. So in the shooting sports is a discipline that if a given person is allowed a given opportunity with the proper amount of time, they can excel. And I truly believe one thing, even in hunting, even in any of the outdoor sports that we do, that a lot of people look at it with the wrong perspective, is that if I know somebody who is just an absolute killer, you know what I mean? He's killing whitetails, he's killing birds, he's picking up shed antlers, you know what I mean? Just like 24/7, and that is absolutely awesome. But at the end of the day, you know, you started the conversation tonight by saying like, I don't know what to do with myself, I don't have my kids. Well, there's a lot of toss-ups with these individuals that have time, and there's other things that they've given up in their lives, where if you live to hunt and that's all that you do, and maybe you don't have a wife and you don't have kids, and maybe you're not that well established in your own home or having a home, or you travel around, a certain person given a, you know, certain situation with enough time should be very good at their craft, should be phenomenal at their craft. But a lot of us that truly enjoy this stuff, we're not, you know, I mean, we don't sacrifice the family or the responsibility to throw the caution to the wind to say, you know what I mean, I'm going to figure this out and get good at it at all costs. And that's what one perspective on things that I think people don't understand when they see somebody that's very, very good in this industry is that they have to say, what have they given up? You know, if you talk to any of the old school, and don't get me wrong, let's use like Michael Wiedel for an example, you know what I mean? Creating Bone Collector, coming from being a Realtree cameraman, you know, he did phenomenal in the industry and created a brand. And there's been certain people who have done that and have done very well. And I think that if, you know, I've met the guy several times, he's always super nice. He still introduces himself as, hi, my name's Michael. So, you know, people that kept their heads on their shoulders over the years, but did very well. But I also think that those guys are a little more few and far between. Just from my slight experience in the industry, you know, if you didn't own a company or own a product, if you're just a face on a TV show, or even whether it be a YouTube channel, a TV show, or anything like that, there's not hundreds of thousands of dollars laying down at your doorstep every day. You know what I mean? You're working to get the sponsors and get the recognition and get something going. People don't hand you money unless they're making money. So you need to give people a reason to buy a product, to have a sponsor. You know what I mean? It all snowballs and goes from there. But yeah, I believe that from the phone or the computer screen, you know what I mean? I think people look at individuals in the industry and think that it's, you know what I mean, roses and rainbows every day. And it's, I don't believe that's the case at all from anybody that I ever knew. And, you know, people that did well, they worked hard to get there.
Dude, preach, because I've been trying to, you know, I've struggled with that, you know, seeing people that are successful and when I'm not successful, and it's really perspective. And, you know, whatever you're consuming in media, you're getting the highlight reel. Almost always you're getting the highlight reel, and you don't see the full picture. And everybody's circumstances are different, and it's no knock on anybody that has more time and uses more time, but that doesn't mean that you can compare yourself in that case. And I think that was so well said, Rich.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And that's been a tough one even for myself, like knowing and being able to understand that it's like, and I was just telling somebody this, I think it was yesterday or Saturday. I was just telling somebody this, they asked me something about, you know, working as much as I am, so on and so forth. And I said, you know, I said, I don't mind working as much as I am. I definitely, you know, you could ask my wife, I get pretty miserable if I don't get some time to play. But I think worse than anything, which has nothing to do with being successful working or doing good things or, you know what I mean, creating a good home, it's, and I said to them that I kind of feel bad that I feel this way. And it's not that I ever feel bad if any of my friends or anybody shoots a buck. Like, I'll always be there, I'll always be happy. But I question myself where I'm like, if it's that time of the year and I'm like working a lot or something, I'm like, what am I doing with my life? You know, I'm like, it's time. Like, I know it's time because my buddies are killing. Why am I here turning a wrench right now? This is craziness. You know, so I'm never jealous of anybody that's killing. And I want all my friends, I want everybody to do well. But I sit back and I just look at it. I'm like, what am I doing right now? Like, I got to work on this. I got to get out there. And, you know, and it is what I mean. Still, as long as you're successful day to day, it's all good. So I guess I'm just, you know, complaining about simple problems.
Oh, I do it all the time. Trust me. There's many, many times where it's go time and I'm doing something I don't want to do, but that's life.
Yep.
Well, yep. As we get into summer here and we're talking about preparing, and everybody wants to talk about glassing, spotting, trail cameras, you know, covering ground, and I love that stuff. But there's one aspect that I've been getting guilty of more and more the past few years, and that's not putting as much time into my shooting equipment. Mm-hmm. And I've been fortunate, like, I'm not God's gift to shooting, but I usually hold my own, and I've done pretty well. But I do notice the past few years as I've shot my bow less, I'm not as sharp. I don't take as much time, you know, with some of the newer weapons that I've had or you know, weapons I want to switch. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, I have an inline muzzleloader, and I had planned to take that hunting last year, But when I shot it on paper, like the load that I was shooting, something changed, and I was trying to make a load and make it more accurate, and I just couldn't get it on paper. So rather than spending the time to use, I just didn't use it, and I switched weapons and stuff like. But I realized it was a time in my life where I would have taken more time to prepare for that, and I just want to talk about honing our shooting skills before the season. So I guess as we start, give us a little bit of a background about some of the shooting that you've done. I know you've done a little bit of competition, and you do instruction and a lot of stuff. So share with us what you got going on in that world.
All right, everyone, it's that time of year where things are greening up and I'm starting to think about food plots. And if you're doing the same thing, look no farther than Vitalize Seed, specifically Nitro Boost spring and summer planting. It's the food plot that has the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen and add diversity to your food plot mix. It's highly browse tolerant and adds a ton of benefit, not just to the wildlife, but for your soil. 30% more diversity than any other food plot you're going to find, and it's engineered for the proper carbon to nitrogen ratio to naturally feed your soil biology and set you up for a fall food plot like no other. Diversity is king for your wildlife and for your soil. Look no farther and check out Vitalize Seed.
So when I was, I want to say 25 or 26, I had just by dumb luck went to shoot at one of my local ranges, and they had a 3-gun match, and you know, they were just like, hey, if you got, you know, if you got your ear protection and your eye protection, you can go up through all the pits and watch. And I watched, and I never knew this even existed. And you know, I grew up, of course, watching, you know, shooting sports on, you know, Sunday evenings and stuff on on all the outdoor channels, but I just didn't know that that existed. So I instantly was just absolutely amazed by this. So, I mean, I think within seeing the first match, I had bought some equipment, and that was kind of the end of summer. So I tinkered with some equipment, and then that's early spring, the first early spring then, I had started, I don't want to just say competing, but like shooting. I'd go to practices with guys, and a lot of the guys were very helpful. You know, that first year I did okay. I figured out, you know, I had some stuff to work on, but you know, I was pretty good with a shotgun from the waterfowl side of things. I could shoot a rifle well, and pistol I could shoot well, but I did so much poor shooting with a pistol that when I got started that I ended up taking some lessons, and I'm very glad that I did. There was a gentleman, Howard Thompson, that used to run one of the clubs around that we would shoot at, and he was a phenomenal pistol shooter. And he let me do some private lessons with him, and that drastically improved my pistol shooting. So that was like year one and two-ish. Then year three, when I started competing, I picked up some like local sponsors just to kind of help out, gun shops that I knew. And then I got hooked up with the gun shop that I teach for now, Sensibly Armed, on I think my fourth year. And then I competed for 4 more years. And from that point on, then I'd gotten a bunch of other sponsors. I had a pistol and a rifle sponsor. We had cleaning supplies. I was hooked up with Hodgson powders. We had bullets, triggers, all kinds of stuff. So, and which really helps when you're shooting that much. Honestly, the hardest sponsors to truly get are bullets and powder and ammo. I mean, that those are the ones that are the hardest to pick up because that's a big expense for them versus, you know, you get a trigger sponsor, they send you 2 triggers, you know, even if it's a retail $350 trigger, you know, what do they have into that? Maybe 30% of that possibly. So, you know, at the end of the day, that those things aren't big expenses for a company to hand out for representation. But yeah, and being involved in the shop that allowed me to have a purchasing avenue where I could purchase stuff at a reasonable cost. I've always done my own reloading. So, I mean, back in the day, we were shooting, oh my gosh, I was running 2 3-gun practices a night, and I think we would shoot 500 to 600 pistol rounds a week. We were shooting 300 to 400 rifle rounds a week, and we'd probably shoot 200 shotgun shells a week, and that's without a match on a Saturday or Sunday or two. So that was just 2 nights a week throughout the year, as long as it wasn't too cold to be on a range. That's what we did. But competed for I want to say another 4 years then at that point. So it would have been the late teens, around like 18 or 19, I stopped competing. But it was fun. I learned a lot. Some of the people that I got to shoot with were just awesome. Some of the people that, you know, are super famous people, like we shot with Jerry Mikulik several times and wow. His family. He's the kind of guy that he also, when he, you know, you walk up and you could be standing there shooting and get down a stage and he might come up to look at it. And, you know, he'd just say, "Hey, what's going on here? You know, my name's Jerry." You know, he introduces himself like you don't know him, you know, which is good. It's very humbling. But yeah, I've gotten to travel around on the East Coast a little bit and do some shooting. And I quite honestly learned a lot. And going from learning what I did shooting three gun and transferring that into any of the shooting that we do in hunting, I mean, it was such an advantage. It's undescribable, just the advantage in what we learned. Even like with pistol shooting, when I became, and mind you, I'm not a, you know what I mean? I'm not an absolute phenomenal pistol shooter. I'm a good proficient pistol shooter. So when I became very proficient with a pistol, that's when I will tell you that my archery shooting like took leaps and bounds forward, which had truly nothing to do necessarily with one or the other, but pistol shooting as a whole, the way that you are going to have a shooting process and the way that your, you know, your pin or your front sight is basically going to dictate the speed of what allows you to, that you can shoot. Once like all the concepts from pistol shooting really sunk in and I got good at that, then it made archery shooting like way easier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do get to watch a lot of guys that go through processes of target panic. And there's how many podcasts where guys will go through a whole, you know, archery process of target panic. And I completely understand what target panic is. I've had it before. I've gotten through it. And I will tell you that if you want to work on target panic, shoot a pistol a lot. The process is the same. Accuracy is a little more difficult. And instead of just a bow going off, you, of course, have recoil and you have your report from the gun. So it's even a little more stressful. So if you can become proficient shooting a pistol, shooting a bow and getting over target panic is an absolute breeze.
So I've heard people make comments about competition shooting is not necessarily that well replicated, or it doesn't simulate hunting situations. I've heard people kind of make negative comments, which I never understood. So, Rich, from your perspective as a competition shooter and hunting, is there any validity or truth in somebody wanting to badmouth competition shooting and how it translates to hunting in any way, shape, or form?
So, all right, so let's break this down as far as, we'll just say as far as like skill set. So, if you're the guy that, you know, just shoots on the weekend, you know, at a pistol match or a three-gun match here or there, and you know, you just have fun doing it and shooting some ammo and you don't really care what you score, and that may have some truth to it, because I will tell you, like shooting... Like, let's just say pistol shooters, when they're shooting steel, a lot of times you're shooting at a steel target that truly has no bullseye on it. If you hit it, you hit it. So accuracy becomes relative to the size of the target. So, you know, if you're shooting a 10-inch plate at 15 yards, how accurate are you? Are you shooting a 2-inch dot on paper? No, you hit the plate? Yeah, so you're accurate. So at the end of the day, I can understand why somebody might make that comment and go down that road. But if you were somebody who took a lot of time to practice and be good at your sport, then there's just no comparison, because, you know, you take shooting on a timer, which the speed part of it has truly not much to do with it at all. But the fact is, when you implement a timer, you implement stress. So anytime you get to continuously shoot under stress, that truly helps you when you're hunting, because what is hunting? It's shooting under stress. Yep. That's what buck fever is. So if you go out there and you be serious about your shooting sports, you're going to shoot under stress every single match. I mean, you go to a match, you shoot 6 or 7 stages a day, you just shot 7 bucks. So you take that type of experience over several years with anybody, and then you apply that to hunting, it really, it levels that playing field as far as nerves are going to go. You know, I'm sure everybody still gets nervous. I still get nervous. But it allows you to mentally.
All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF, for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan and Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
We see what's going to happen. So I think that's the biggest thing with, you know, with hunting, is that in that moment, being able to like break down your emotions and what's happening is very difficult, because you just don't get the repetition of the experience. So big bucks coming in, it doesn't matter if it's with a bow or a gun, you know, your nerves are going, you're getting excited, but your brain is not telling you that, hey, calm down, you know what this is, work your way through it, use your shot process. Usually that's not even in a typical person's mind. And that's where the competition shooting and working under stress comes into play, because you can control that. You can work around all that. That situation is already easy enough. And instead of being nervous and trying to get a shot in, well, now your brain's actually looking and focusing and saying, okay, where am I going to shoot? How's this going to go? And actually working yourself through a shot process instead of, I would love to know the statistic, and we never could because there's no way to prove it. But if you just think about in Pennsylvania, let's just say, and I know this number's off, but let's just say 100,000 deer get shot with a rifle opening day. How many of those deer did they squeeze the trigger to shoot?
Very
few.
You
know what I mean? Like, correct. Very correct. Fun. And that's where that all kind of comes into play. You know, especially with once you get to know your, and that's the basis of it too, is also getting to know your equipment. You know, if you think about, because we're in Pennsylvania, we'll use that as a prime example. Like, we probably grew up the same. If the old guys could hit a pie plate at 75 yards, like, that good gun was good to go, you know, which is a far cry from accurate in today's world and how we do things. You know, I, of course, grew up with all the stereotypes. You know, we better shoot our gun each year to make sure that it's still on. You know, even when I was a kid, I had a Leupold VX3 on my 06. It's like, where did that thing go from year to year? It didn't. It never went anywhere, but we still had to shoot 3 rounds just to make sure the gun was still on.
Yep.
You know, all that different stuff. So, but at the end of the day, that 3 rounds a year, I mean, that doesn't make you a proficient shooter or even slightly qualified to be very good at operating your firearm. I mean, you know, I've been in situations hunting with people many a times where they just, guys didn't really know how to operate their own firearm, or got into not trouble or really had an accident, but you know, where it's kind of like, hey, whoa, what are we doing here? What's up with that? You know, it's the amount of time you get to spend with it, you know, and that's where the shooting sports comes into play, it's something to do in the off season where, you know, you're constantly around firearms or gunfire and, you know, working on the skills, being proficient, just handling guns. You know, if you think about most people, how often do they get to handle a firearm? Now, mind you, if you conceal carry, you handle a firearm probably every day. You know, there's plenty of people that do that, but you just think about your general person who's a hunter, you know, how often do you pick up your rifle and look through it?
Not that often. I think that's a great point. I'm glad you brought up the competition and the stress involvement, because I haven't really competed at much of a level, at much of any level, but I've competed enough to understand that that stress helps you. It's probably the closest simulation you can get to hunting that you'll possibly experience not hunting, from my point of view. I remember one time I watched a video, and don't quote me on it, the words, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but what sticks in my memory, it was Levi Morgan was talking about competition shooting versus hunting. And he said something along the lines of, for him, competing at that level that he shoots at, competition shooting is way harder than shooting a big buck. And so many people that hunt would just be baffled by that, mm-hmm. because you know the stress of putting yourself in with a trophy animal. Like we can do it. I think lack of preparedness is where that gets a lot of us going. So let's just talk about preparedness right now. I said earlier, like, I don't shoot as much as I used to. Some of that is my body isn't quite as strong as it used to be, and I haven't taken as good a care of myself. Some of it's the thing we talked about in the beginning of this podcast is time. I just don't associate time as much as I used to, and I need to. So I just want to go through Rich. I just want to go through what Rich would do, whether it's your process or what you'd recommend to somebody. But let's just talk about the off season. Here it is. It's June. You know, unless you're going to clubs and shooting stuff, most people haven't dusted off equipment, but now we're, you know, setting the timer on archery season or whatever fall season you're into. So the clock says go, and we're going to get started. What in your mind is going to get you started right this off season leading to season with your bow, guns, whatever?
So I'm glad you said both, because they're definitely both two different animals, we'll say.
Sure.
So the easiest, of course, is a bow, because most everybody can shoot a bow at home. So I will only shoot 6 to 12 arrows a night. And like my process, once we hit midsummer here, and now I do shoot indoor archery in the winter, which we just have a blast doing. It's not really, we have, you know, we keep track of our points, but nobody cares at the end of the night. You know, it's more of a joke than anything. We don't shoot a league, but we have a good time doing it. And excuse me, we do shoot, you know, 20 yard Vegas spot. And that truly, it helps a lot of the on the line skills, to get to springtime, then also to shoot during the summer. So once we hit summer and now I say, okay, it's time to pick the hunting bow back up and get some arrows shot. Typically I will try to shoot every night for midsummer on. And it doesn't matter to me if it's 6 arrows or 12 arrows. The biggest thing that I will honestly say is that I don't ever take for granted one shot. So if I go out back and I'm going to shoot, I want every shot to count. And if it doesn't, I need to know what I did. There's no throwaways. Because if I'm hunting, there's not a throwaway. So to refer back to competition shooting, there was a guy that used to shoot a lot, and he used to shoot for the Benelli team. Great guy. We got along great because he was a hunter. And honestly, most of the guys that competed were not hunters. So I got along great with him. And I remember talking to him, and he would tell me that his warm up for pistol shooting was 10-inch plates at 80 yards. And he would shoot those plates at 80 yards to start. He would just shoot, you know, 10 rounds or less. And he would just make it count, and he would shoot those plates, and then he would move in, and then he would do his drills. And when he told me he did that, I was kind of like, man, how comes you, why do you shoot so far to start? And he said, well, it's the hardest shot. He said, so I want to shoot my hardest shot first because I'm the freshest. So when I come out and shoot in my yard, you know, I'll shoot 40 every now and again. I mean, you know, even the years that we'd go shoot tack, you know, we'd we'd shoot to 120 yards to go shoot tack. But I would always shoot 30 in the yard right as my starter. And honestly, a lot of times I won't even move off of 30 because if my 30 is good, I know my 20 is good. So I find that 30 is that sweet spot of difficulty to where if I'm shooting at 30 and I'm feeling really good about 30, anything 30 and under should just be smoke. There shouldn't be a question about it. So, but that's my general, you know, I'll do that right to the beginning of season. And then once season starts, I will say one thing that has helped me a lot, and this is a stance problem that I had had in the past. But I do have, like at the house here, of course, I have an archery target. Like at our shop, I have an archery target. So if I'm going to hunt at the house or the shop, or if I'm leaving the house, I will shoot. I always have a couple arrows out, but I will shoot just one shot before I leave to go hunt. And I realize you can't do that in the morning. So this is afternoon, but I'll shoot one shot. And what that shot is doing is just reminding me of everything that I need to do to make it right. And the issue that I had had is that I would shoot about 4 inches left. And what I figured out that I was doing was that I was not squaring my body up to my feet. I was basically pulling my bow arm inward and essentially changing where my anchor point was. So that was something I realized years ago, and shooting that one shot, you know, not that it has to happen, but that has been something that if I shoot that one shot before I go, then I always feel 100% confident once I get in the field. Moving on to the rifle side of things, or muzzleloader, or any of it, is that I am the kind of guy that I want to know what my ammo is doing, and I really want to know what it's doing to animals. So if you ever get to chat with any of my buddies, like I have a really good friend, Justin, and like he was just down in Texas shooting axis deer, and he shoots a Win Mag, and I shoot a Win Mag for my longer range hunting. And he had been shooting Barnes bullets. And 2 years ago, he sent me a picture where he shot an Audad. And he sends me a picture of a Barnes bullet in his hand. And it looks like a banana. Like it's slightly bent, the blue tip still on it. And I said, what happened? It made no sense. And he says, we just pulled that out of the front shoulder of the Audad. So that, and now a Barnes bullet is designed to expand. A lot of solid coppers are not designed to expand. They're designed to tumble. So he shot that animal with the, I want to say it was the TSX, and he shot it twice, got his animal. Well, then he was down in Texas. I know I'm going to say this wrong. I always want to say it's an eland, but it's not an eland. It's kind of like a newer animal they have down there, but they're big.
An exotic? Kind of like
horse face with like a little. They're gray. And they're huge.
Well, eland would be the biggest. That's like the comparison version in Africa to a moose. But I mean, yes. There's. Is it a Nilgai? Is a
Nilgai?
Okay.
Yep. Nilgai. So he was just in Texas this year, and first day he shoots this Nilgai, and he shoots suppressed, and he called a hit. It was under 200 yards, and the guide said he didn't hit it. So Justin's like, I'm pretty positive I hit that animal. So they go look, no blood where it was. Well, they found it dead about 400 yards away the next day. So same deal, Barnes bullet, zipped right through. They couldn't even find an exit wound on it, but that was his animal. It was right there in the same, I guess they would call it a paddock down there. But so I said to him, I'm like, you have a problem. Like I can see that, you know what I mean? There's an issue here. So I had been loading some Barnes bullets. I'm sorry. I had been loading some Burger bullets. I'm looking at them right now on the side. And they were shooting phenomenal in my gun. We shot them in his gun. And I loaded them up 50. And I was like, take these, you know, shoot your axis deer. So he ended up letting one of the other guys use his gun. So they killed two axis deer, flattened them both. And he sends me a picture of a bullet that's fully mushroomed, all cupped up. And I'm like, okay, that's what I want to see. Like, and that's me. Like, I want to know what my bullets are doing. I want to know that they're performing correctly. So the start of, and the beginning of summer is going to be load data, testing, shooting different distances. And that may seem like I'm on the range all the time. I'm truly not. The really cool part about long range shooting, good buddy of mine, Ken, he's a phenomenal long range shooter. He competes all the time. he's taught me more just fussing around on his home range than I've ever learned trying to do research. But, you know, most of your battles are won in the loading room. So, you know, if you don't have time to be on the range, you have time to be in the loading room and get stuff right to prep before you go. But I would say, you know, having your equipment right, having your ammo sorted, and whether that's going to be, of course, shotgun, rifle, muzzleloader, and then getting some time behind the gun. And I would say, you know, bench time is great, but where I think a lot of people really drop the ball or forget the situation at hand is that, you know, if you're going to go out west and try and shoot a mule deer, right, everybody shoots, let's just say, out to 300 or 400 yards. You have a bipod on the gun, but how many of those guys tried to shoot a, you know, a 10-inch pie plate at 50 yards with a bipod and a suppressor on the gun? That's a big gun. So, you know, a lot of times it's preparing for the unexpected shot versus, you know, worrying about the accuracy part of it. The accuracy part is easy, but that those skills are a lot more difficult. But, you know, I would say, you know, rifle manipulation, being able to shoot in different situations, whether it be offhand, maybe just single post on a tree or a post or anything like that, you know, and knowing your equipment. But, you know, that would be the process. Just kind of, I look at my fall hunts, like this year is going to be Kansas muzzleloader in September. I just built a smokeless muzzleloader. So I just got that thing all set to go. I've got loads ready. I got to shoot that. And that, I'm hoping to get that shot out to 600. And that's before September, so my window's closing here quickly. But, and then I do have my Win Mag ready to go. I shot that to 550. We are going to Montana in November, so that I feel really good about. And this year I rebuilt a 308 Ruger M77 this past winter that I have had forever, shot plenty of deer with it, but I wanted to put a suppressor on it. So I threaded it and rebedded it and did a little paint job on it and shortened up the stock so I could shoot it with a backpack on and did some tricks. So I got to do a little practice with that as well. But I know that just sounded like a whole lot of range time.
It does sound like a lot of range time, but when you break down everything you talked about, you can break it into increments. Like you talked about,
Absolutely. You talked about
loading. Like that's an increment of time. And like if you do, I struggle with this with everything of life, whether it's just exercising or eating right or shooting my bow or do is like sometimes a little bit on consistency is better than a lot in one sum. So, you know, you're talking about manipulating a load, you know, doing whatever you got to do on the reloading bench, whether it's 20 minutes, a half hour, you know, a couple nights a week or whatever, tinkering, manipulating stuff, whether it's getting, you know, reading content or something to better that preparation. Maybe it's something form related and shoot like, you know, one of the things I personally love doing as an archer is I love to blank bail, whether it's taking my sight off my bow and shooting close or closing my eyes or doing something, but working on just muscle memory in shooting and not really worrying about stuff, but just little reps, I think go a long way. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is really, really hard, and I've experienced this, is like, anybody who is a really, really good coach for themselves, I think, is on a new level. I think it is really, really hard to be your own coach because, number one, I'm the biggest critic of myself, and number two, there's a level of self doubt. Like if Rich and I go hunting together, like I'm gonna have a little bit of anxiety and a decision to make, and you're gonna have rationale behind it because you're seeing it from the sidelines and you can make a rational decision. I don't have emotion tied to it, so. You know, take that in with the shooting side of things. How do you try to evaluate yourself when something is going wrong with shooting?
So I'm actually glad you brought that up. So, of course, you know, I do quite a bit of predator hunting. And one thing that I have an issue with, and a good buddy of mine, Kevin, we were just talking about it the other day. He was one of my partners when we used to shoot team events. Kevin's a phenomenal shooter. And he said to me the other day, I didn't even get to bring this up myself. He goes, man, he's like, because he, so I took him predator hunting in October, and I think by, or late October, and I think by November, he had a gun, a scanner, a call, and like was all in on this. So he hunted all winter long, had a great time with it. But he goes, I don't miss much. He says, but I am hell on shooting low. And I said, that's really funny you say that. Excuse me. Because I do the same thing. I have a really bad habit. Now, mind you, like when we're shooting predators, especially if they're stationary, that's when I'll shoot low. And what I'm doing is I take my crosshairs, I place the crosshairs under my target, I lock down my tripod, and then I'm applying head weight. The tripod's locked down, but I'm applying head weight to basically pull my crosshairs into my target, and then I'm going to squeeze the trigger. But what's happening in that process, by locking it down and adding head weight, I'm taking away my actual float. Like, if you allow that tripod to come on top of a target and you're going to try and hold steady, you'll never stop moving. There'll always be a float factor. And most of the time, most people aren't, and I'm doing a circle with my fingers, but like most people aren't actually controlling that float factor. It's just kind of crazy. So if you lock it down and you pull in the target, that kind of locks you down so that you're not really getting any float. So I have a bad habit of breaking the trigger before I'm in center mass of a fox or a coyote, and it has bitten me in the ass more times than I can count. Good buddy of mine, Tanner, he hunts with me probably the most, and he jokes every time. He's like, shot low, you know. It's like, yep, you did it again, shot low. You know, I've shot a pile of coyotes where I've literally shot them, you know, behind the shoulder, but like just enough to catch the bottom of the heart, and you know, they'll run 30, 40 yards and pile up, but it's just not flattening them. So that's something that in the moment, to answer your question, in the moment to correct it, it's not that it's impossible, but you got to make sure you're remembering that the issue is there. And I think that's the excitement part where a lot of people will mess something up because they get excited and you're forgetting about the issues that could come up, where, you know, when you're competing or you shoot a lot, you're always focusing on the issues, because honestly, the issues are what you need to correct. That's no different from bow shooting or rifle shooting. But, you know, being cognizant to know your weakness is probably the biggest strength you could possibly have when you're shooting or hunting. You know, even so, good example, great example. So this year was rifle season, and most of us didn't even have buck tags. So we just go up to the mountains and have a great time shooting does. So I like to just walk a ridge, and I'll walk like 50 yards, crest the ridge, look over, back off, you know, and just do ridge bumps like that by myself. So crest the ridge, I can see there's two deer. One's a doe, one's like a four corn. So I'll bet she was maybe like, I don't know, 90-ish yards at that point. And I mean, I was standing next to a tree, and like, that's not a very, you know what I mean, 90 yards with my hand on a tree, like, that's not a very hard shot. But like, I have nothing to prove. There's nobody watching me. So I was just like, I'm not going to do that. I dropped down on my knees. I got rid of my backpack. I just left my backpack fall. And I mean, it was snowy and wet, and I didn't really care because I just wanted to shoot this deer. So I literally just, you know what I mean, crawled up another like 20 some yards to the next tree. So then I just got up on my knees, got on the tree, shot her. She ran 20 yards and piled up. But I knew, you know, when I saw that deer, even at the 90 yard mark, I knew I could shoot it, but I also just knew that it would just be a better shot being closer. So, you know, if you're 100% positive on the shot, then that's totally fine. I know I've said this before on other podcasts, you know, if you're going to try and shoot a deer that's coming to you and it's at 120 yards and it's standing there broadside and you're on a rest, it doesn't matter if it's at 120 or 100, you kill it at the first possible moment that you can. But if there's any risk involved, then you want to, of course, stack your deck and gain the advantage.
Absolutely.
So the funny part about that story is that a good friend of mine, Hepler was up there with us, and we were going to go do those same bumps, and Hepler shot one. So I said, hey, go along this ridge, do these bumps. I'm going to go help Hepler. So I left, and my buddy goes along this ridge, and I'm over with Hepler, and I hear a shot, and I'm like, I wonder if that was my buddy. So then I get up to him later, and I'm like, did you shoot? He's like, yeah, I missed a doe. And I'm like, what happened? He's like, wow, I crested that knob, and she, like, saw me, and she's like, she ran out to, like, 100 yards and stopped and looked around. And his exact words were, he goes, I should have gotten to a tree, but he tried to shoot freehand.
Mm.
So, you know what I mean? It's like, I feel like the ego is there where it'll bite you in the ass when you're like, I got this, but you don't have this. You know what I mean? Where you're like, I can make that shot, but you can't. You know, I feel like stacking the deck for success is being aware enough to put yourself in a better position or the best position possible, you know, to guarantee a good shot.
And some of that's too tough too, because you put pressure on yourself that like you got to get it done, especially like in a situation like you just said with your buddy, where the deer saw you and you feel like I got to shoot or I'm going to lose my opportunity. And then you end up forcing something that, you know, I not all the time, but often, you have more time in the woods to shoot than you realize. A lot of the time, I've done it so many times where I've rushed shots, it's like, you idiot, take your time.
Yeah, even, it's just taking things for granted, not going through the process. I mean, I remember one time, I have this on video, it's probably on my Facebook somewhere because I self-filmed it. I had just gotten in the stand. It was November 6th. This is going to be goofy. November 6th, 2016, I believe it was. I don't know why I even remember that. Or 2015. No, 16. So I had just gotten into my stand in the afternoon, and I wanted to move. So I took was still hunting out of a climber sometimes at that point. So got up and stayed on my climber. I got my camera set up. I just pulled my bow up, knocked an arrow, and here comes these deer. And here's this buck. He's probably like 110-inch, maybe 115-inch 8-pointer. And like, I'm going to shoot that. I had no problem shooting him. And he's already been shot. Like, he has an arrow in his shoulder sticking out of his, you know, literally in the ball of the shoulder, full-length arrow. So this deer was dead to rights. I literally got the camera ready, camera's focused, GoPro's running, everything's good to go. You know what I didn't do? Range that damn thing. Like, why wouldn't I range it? So, you know, he comes in, and I'm like, yep, you're dead. Draw my bow. Break the shot, arrow goes right under his pocket. Thought it was 21 yards. It was 31 yards. So, you know, it's, and that's the thing. It's the dumb stuff. It's, you know, think about how many deer survive just by us making the stupidest little mistakes that, you know, they're dead to rights and it,
right.
And they get away. You know, those are the ones you look back at that you, and that I will say though, too, that's where you're learning. You know, if you're not learning from those mistakes you're making, you're not doing yourself any good. That's for sure.
Oh, 100%. That's the biggest thing, too. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do in the off-season shooting is make sure our mechanics are as sound as possible, so that way when the emotion comes into it, hopefully our mechanics go into autopilot and we outweigh that. But you're still going to make little mishaps and stuff because, you know, if you're used to shooting, you know, I'll take my place here. You know, I'm used to going out to my pad where I've got set up to shoot my bow, and I've got my 20, 30, 40 all the way out to 100-yard targets. And, you know, I pick my targets, and I'm shooting them from that location. And I adjust where I shoot and how I shoot. But for the most part, like, I'm setting myself up in those practice situations for perfect shots. And sometimes, like you brought it up earlier, you got to practice for the imperfect so you're prepared, because when it's imperfect, you know, that's where you allow your emotion to overcome your logic and your reason.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%.
So I feel like we barely scratched the surface, and that's okay, because there's a lot to unpack with this. So last thing I guess we'll discuss real quick. You brought up target panic. And target panic gets talked about mostly in archery, but target panic happens in all aspects of shooting.
Absolutely.
And you'll commonly hear the only way to break it is, you know, from archery side is with back tension and shooting surprise releases and stuff like that, which I agree, and I try to impose a surprise release. You brought that up earlier. But just on the surface with all of your shooting, how does that translate from archery into all the other stuff? Is it just as simple as squeezing the trigger in order to break that for you? I don't know where to go with that, Rich. I guess what I'm getting at is I find it unique that there's a lot of people that say this is the only way to do it. For instance, back tension shooting. But there's a lot of other archery shooters, whether they're just utilizing the squeeze the trigger if you're using a release aid type shot, or even some command shooters that are, you know, they call it command shooting. I call it they punch, but they can do it without anticipation. So I don't know what to do with that. And I guess I'm asking you as somebody who's coached and stuff, like, where do you go with that? And how do you take that? If I'm dealing with target panic in any piece of equipment, where do I go from here to hopefully do better this fall?
So I'm going to go down a rabbit hole of pistol shooting, if you're okay with that.
Send it.
All right. So when we teach classes, so I teach one class that's an advanced accuracy pistol class. And the whole purpose of the class is to basically teach somebody how to repeatedly shoot accurately. And I know that that is, as a whole, that's what you're supposed to be trying to do, but it's a lot more difficult than what it sounds like. So pistol shooting is a really easy one to use target panic for, because I mean, I'll bet you, so let's put it this way, the reason why people are inaccurate pistol shooters is because of target panic, period, the end. You know, you have a firearm in your hand that most of the time, you know, and these are the scenarios that we get into, is that I get a pistol shooter that comes in, they're pretty good with their pistol, but they bought, you know, a subcompact because, of course, everybody's first pistol they buy when they turn 21 is a carry gun. Nobody buys a full-size 1911 or a full-size SIG 226 or something with some weight to it to say, hey, I'm going to learn how to shoot properly with the least amount of stress involved. So the bigger the pistol, the less recoil, the more weight, the less you can move it. And quite frankly, 1911s, with the way that the backstrap safety is and the way that the thumb safety is, a 1911 makes you put your hands where they were intended to be. That's the design. So we get a lot of shooters that already have some bad habits, and the whole goal is to work around that bad habit. The bad habit is target panic. So what I essentially call target panic with a pistol is I call it throwing it away. So you can work your process of shooting right up until the moment of pulling the trigger, and your brain knows that the gun's going to recoil and it's going to go bang, and most people will do what I had just said. They throw it away. So you cannot, I mean, I'm going to do this in somewhat slow-mo because, of course, we're here on camera, but if you were to watch them, you almost, it's fast. It's real fast. But essentially, they're ready to pull the trigger, and they might as well close their eyes and rip on the trigger. And they get a very inconsistent pattern that does not allow you to say, hey, this is what you're doing. It almost becomes uncoachable because they're throwing the shot away. They're not, you know, somebody who has a little bit of target panic with a pistol, if they're a right-handed shooter, typically they're going to follow low left. And that's the push from the right hand to anticipate recoil. That can be overcame. But when they're just simply throwing it away, that's very difficult to overcome. So what I try to explain to everybody is that you need to shoot a pistol like you're shooting a rifle on a bench. The gun is just there. You need to work the trigger, and it needs to surprise you. And I know everybody mostly knows that. But the biggest example that I will tell everybody, and this is like the aha moment, this is like the dumbest thing ever, but a lot of people played baseball or softball or something like that growing up. I'm sure you did too. So everybody has hit a ball where it wrung your hands and it hurt, mm-hmm. right? But nobody ever walked up to the plate scared of that. So when you start talking about anticipating on pistol shooting, but you played sports, like, it's all mental. You need to basically be able to tell yourself and just accept and say, like, okay, I understand there's going to be recoil involved. I understand this is going to go off, and I'm going to walk myself through it and squeeze the trigger. And a lot of people, once you start giving them the examples, which is basically, you're essentially just calming them down to let them understand that it is okay. Like, this is not going to be comfortable. It's not supposed to be comfortable at first. It takes a lot of repetitions for this all to be normal. We've done things even where we go into class and I'll have everybody blow up a balloon. The first night in class we do, like, in a classroom. And I just go over, like, stance and grip. And then we talk about the interpretation of accuracy, because that's different from everybody. Like I had said earlier, if you shot at a 10-inch plate at 15 yards and you hit the plate, you were 100% accurate. But how accurate were you? Mm-hmm. So I'll have them blow up balloons, and then we take a thumbtack, and I have them pop their balloons one at a time. You wouldn't believe how many people close their eyes to pop a balloon, where it's a, you know what I mean? Because you know it's going to pop, and that's the anticipation. And that's a balloon. That's not even when we're in shooting pistols. So I go through that process to say, okay, and I don't tell them what we're doing. I just say, all right, everybody's going to blow up a balloon. We're going to, you know, you're going to say your name and you get to pop your balloon. And then I say to everybody, like, hey, watch them pop their balloon. And as you go through and you see how many people flinched, you see how many people flinched that had the balloon pop next to them, you know it's coming. And then I simply explain, that's what just happened with a balloon. We're getting ready to walk into a 6-bay range. There's going to be 10 shooters firing pistols at the same time. Like, you're creating a very stressful situation, and that's okay. We need to, you know, just be calm. We're all going to mentally work our way through this. And at the end of the day, we work off of a shot process that 100% has to be followed. And if the shot process is not followed, you cannot fire the gun. Now, mind you, I tell everybody that, and I say, okay, if you have all your boxes checked, then you can pull the trigger. If you don't have your boxes checked, then don't pull the trigger. And I'll go back and forth, and, you know, as soon as somebody misses or is, you know, not as accurate as we want them to be, I'll say, well, which number in your shot process are you messing up? And usually the trouble ones are the ones that say, I don't know, because then that's a big problem if you're not aware of which part of your shot process you're messing up. Typically, that's the one that comes down to just simply throwing it away. But we do have a lot of shooters that over the course of, we do 5 weeks, up until week 4, they truly improve 50%. And a lot of it, I believe, is being comfortable, knowing what's going on and why, and also having a group that's working through the same types of problems, because then that shows them that everything they're doing is okay. Come on. There we go. Had something funky going on the screen there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and then once they start to work through that, then they can improve. And I will say, here's the biggest hump that has to happen. And I tell my shooters this all the time. I say confidence will triple your improvement just by being confident in what you're doing. And you have to have good success to be confident. So when I bring my shooters in, they're not allowed to shoot a targeted paper the first night that we're in the range. They shoot blank paper. So what I say is, all right, and we start at 3 yards. I mean, basically point blank. So we start at 3 yards, and I say, okay, shoot one as close to center paper as you can, and stop. They all fire a shot, and I say, okay, now your first shot, that just became your bullseye. So that's what you're going to aim for. And it's amazing taking that actual target out of the situation where there's not a bullseye to fail, how much people improve instantly. I mean, instantly, mm-hmm. they'll just start tearing paper because they're not shooting at a bullseye. There's no stress of missing. They're not stressed because even the first shot, most people hit the center of paper. The reason they hit the center of paper is because they are supposed to be aiming at center of paper, but there's no bullseye. There's nothing to pull away from. So your brain never puts two and two together to say, okay, front sight's on the bullseye, the gun's going to go bang. There's no bullseye. So they put the sight up there, they squeeze the trigger, there's one shot in the center of the paper. So I think the whole process of it, and I think that's part of it, even with archery, is just that, you know, it's not one thing. It's not just saying like, oh, I need to work through this. I need, like you said, I need a, you know, release aid, or, you know, we're going to do some, you know, shooting with no sight, just down the, you know, any of the tricks that could possibly be there. At the end of the day, if you are experiencing target panic, there's something wrong in your shot process. And it's the fact of you're not allowed to shoot until you get to point X. And if you're at point X, then you can squeeze the trigger. But if you're throwing it away, then you're not following your shot process. Because at the end of the day, the last thing in the shot process for a pistol or a bow is my pin on the target? Now I can squeeze. So if your pin's not on the target, you can't squeeze, so you can't shoot.
Well, maybe we need to do a follow-up at some point and talk about shot processes, because we've been rolling for an hour, and there's a lot of stuff that we could pull. There's stuff I pulled away from this, and I think there's a lot that people can pull from this. So, Rich, let's put a pin in this one, and let's circle back at some point here and do the exact same thing and talk about shot processes. So, if yeah. people are listening and they've heard something that they thought was helpful from you, and if they wanted to reach out to you, how would they do that?
You can just message me on either Facebook or Instagram. Facebook is just Rich Yoder. Instagram, I believe, is Bo_Yoder6, I think.
Perfect. Well, Rich, thank you. This was very helpful and very insightful. I appreciate your knowledge.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.